Why?
Diotima gasped. Because my other nipple is feeling jealous. The rest of me needs attention too. Come on, quickly.
What I really want to be, said Petali the Porne, is a hetaira. Those girls have it made. Their own house, regular clients, big money.
She twisted a stray brunette tress around her little finger and looked thoughtful.
I'm working my way up. Gonna have my own place someday.
Would Petali make it? I glanced at Diotima for her reaction, because Diotima was the daughter of a hetaira, and a highly successful one at that. Diotima might cringe at her mother's history, but she knew the business as few respectable women did. When Diotima nodded ever so slightly, I knew she rated Petali a chance to reach the top of her profession. I wondered why. It certainly couldn't be based on her possessions. We sat in Petali's tent, patched and barely large enough for its purpose. A man could stand if he hunched. A couple could lie on the rug, a trifle worn but thick enough and scattered with cushions to cover the stains and the spots where moths had eaten holes. Petali had produced cheap pottery cups and served us wine, which somehow she had managed to chill despite the heat of the day. She had served us with grace, and perhaps this was what Diotima saw. Petali was poor. Everything she owned could be rolled up within the canvas of her tent, but she did the best with what she had. I glanced at Diotima. She glanced at me.
Did I say something funny? How come you're both smiling?
Petali asked.
We're naturally happy people, I said. Where are you from, Petali?
Corinth.
Long way to haul your tent, Diotima commented.
There are men with big carts and donkeys. We girls rent space for our stuff and walk alongside. The bastards charge a small fortune, but what can you do?
Pay in kind?
She laughed.
Not them. They want the money.
Listen, Petali, it's important we know about the man you told Diotima about.
The huge guy, built like a small fort?
That's him. What time did you see him?
You think I watched the time?
She gave me a pitying look.
I was in this tent from the moment the games ended for the day until the middle of the night. The guys couldn't wait to get across the river and at the girls.
So, how did you see Arakos? Was he a customer?
I had to piss. A girl can only take so much before the pressure starts to tell. So I crawled out of my tent, and there he was.
Waiting outside?
Freaked me out, I can tell you. For a moment I thought he was a client, and I had this vision of being crushed to death. Thanks be to Aphrodite, he wasn't waiting.
He didn't stop?
Walked straight by. I don't think he even saw me. Seemed preoccupied, or maybe he was looking for something, I don't know.
Are you sure it was Arakos?
My client recognized him too. We crawled out of the tent together and he said, "What's he doing here?" He was from Sparta too.
You could tell from his accent?
He wanted to pay me with those weird iron bars the Spartans use for money. I wouldn't take it.
I glanced across at Diotima. She looked as frustrated as I felt. Here we had someone who could help us trace the victim, but she couldn't tell the time.
Was Arakos with anyone? On his own.
I don't suppose there was anyone following him, was there? I silently offered Zeus a sacrifice at every Olympics for the rest of my life, if only we could solve this crime with one simple witness. Besides, such an oath would be a good excuse to come and see every games. Petali shrugged.
There was no one else.
I canceled the sacrifices.
This client, what was his name?
Petalie gave me a withering look.
Heracles. They're all named Heracles, or Achilles. The ugly ones call themselves Apollo.
Right, scrap that. Can you describe him?
He looked just like all the other men I saw that night.
I threw my arms up in despair.
You must have some idea of the time. Why? I was flat on my back the whole night.
Petalie looked reflective.
No, actually I was on my knees most of the time, or standing, or bending over, mostly bending over, come to think of it. We get a lot of cheap asses here.
You're kidding.
Wish I were. We charge by the position, you know.
You do?
Said Diotima, whose knowledge of these things was limited to the high end of the business.
I had no idea. Did you, Nico?
No idea, I agreed innocently.
Petalie said,
They walk in demanding the best. That's them on top or me riding. Then when I quote my fee, they whine and end up going for a cheapie. Which is?
Diotima asked.
Me bending over and them behind. Costs less because it's so impersonal, you know. But it's quick. I can get through more guys in a night and I don't have to smell their breath. And let me tell you, that's a bonus. Hard on the calves, though. I get lots of practice touching my toes. I'm very flexible. Want to see?
Sure, I'd love to. I caught Diotima's hard eye. That is, no thanks.
Diotima said.
So most of your clients were cheap. I guess you remember how many were on your back? Only one.
Kneeling?
Three.
Standing or bending?
That's what I don't remember. More than 20 for sure.
Busy!
I told you we girls were full up, so to speak.
This is all very interesting if you like prurient statistics, I said. But it doesn't help. We have to know what time Petalie saw Aurikos.
I can see the details of this wouldn't interest a man, said Diotima. She looked thoughtful. Time's running away on us. It's almost midday already, and there are so many other lines we need to pursue. Why don't you look into them, Nico, while I continue with Petalie?
It seemed to me Petalie was a dead end, so I was happy to agree. But I reminded Diotima, Don't forget our fathers meet this evening to discuss you-know-what. I wasn't inclined to let Petalie in on our personal business.
How could I forget? Said Diotima. Don't worry, I'll be there.
She gave Petalie a calculating look.
Leave this with me, Nico. You have other things to do.
Timodemus was held in an ancient stone cottage, one among a row of such ruins at the foot of Mount Kronos. The cottages were normally used by itinerant artisans who came to work on the grounds of Olympia. Now one cottage held an accused murderer, and another housed the murdered man. The smell, as I passed the cottage that held Aurikos, was a trifle rank. An honor guard of two Spartans, unarmed, of course, stood at the door. They glared at me as I passed. The cottage that held Timo had guards, too, but they weren't for honor, and they were armed soldiers of Elis, the host city. They let me in without a word. Timo sat on a pile of straw on the floor. This was supposed to be his bed. There was no chair, and it felt wrong to stand over him, so we sat side by side with our backs to the wall. The room was claustrophobic, as the rooms in ancient buildings often are. We sat so close our knees touched. The smell of Timodemus was everywhere, but I didn't smell any fear. I handed Timo the ostracon that Marcos had discovered, in which he demanded a meeting with Arakos in the woods at night. Timodemus turned the ostracon round and round.
I never wrote this.
He stared at it.
Never.
Timodemus handed the ostracon back to me. I inspected it once more in search of any clue. To scratch a message into an ostracon is an inconsistent business. The knife slips, much depends on how hard the clay is, and what part of the broken pot is used. I could ask Timo for a sample of his own writing, but I could never match a sample with the evidence. The best I could do was take him at his word, or not. All right, Timo, tell me what you know, and for both our sakes, tell me the truth.
Do you think I killed him?
He asked. I don't know what to think, other than that if we don't come up with some useful facts soon, you'll take a short flight.
Thrown off Mount Taipeum, he mused. Exelon picked the most shameful death he could.
Let's start with the priestess. You were found naked in her tent. I look forward to hearing how that happened. Timo was silent for a moment. He looked down at the ground. Then he said,
That was a mistake.
Oh, really?
All right, Nico, you can be as sarcastic as you like. The truth is, I happened to be passing and I stumbled in by accident.
Timo, there are so many things wrong with that statement, I don't know where to begin. He didn't reply, merely sat there, eyes on the ground.
Well?
I tapped my foot.
This is embarrassing, he muttered.
Embarrassing? As in I wish my best friend didn't know what I'm about to reveal? Or embarrassing as in I'd rather die than anyone know this.
All right, you've made your point.
He paused.
I was looking for a woman.
Any particular woman?
No, as long as she was presentable.
He hung his head.
This is all the fault of Dromaeus.
Your trainer? Timo nodded.
He prescribed sex as part of my training regimen. He says regular sex relaxes the body and makes it more supple.
How regular?
Every night for the last 10 months.
You lucky bastard. I slavered in envy.
You think so? It was easy enough back at home. Plenty of slave girls there.
I nodded. A slave girl couldn't say no, not to the son of her owner, at any rate. Most Athenian men had their first taste of sex at home with their mother's slave girls. But there was one well-known problem with that system. Didn't they get pregnant? Timo shrugged.
A couple of them, but father didn't care. Anything that helps me win an Olympic crown is fine by him.
What will you do with the babies?
The girls hadn't birthed when we left. Father left instructions to expose them, unless they're healthy boys, in which case to keep them as slaves. I didn't like it, but, well, those were father's orders. What could I do?
The child of a slave is a slave, even if the father is a citizen. Whoever owns the mother can do with the baby what he will, even expose the baby to die. It is ugly stuff. People don't like to talk about it, but everyone knows it happens. And One Eye wasn't exactly sentimental. Timodemus continued.
When we moved to Elis in preparation for the games, it became a problem. No handy slave girls, and I could hardly use respectable women, which left the pornoi.
I'm not seeing the problem. Sex every night at your father's expense? It's every man's dream.
You might find this hard to believe, but it became sort of like, well, work.
He was right. I found it hard to believe. So when you walked into Climene's tent, you were on your nightly excursion.
I thought the tent belonged to a porne, a wealthy one. I wasn't the only one doing this, by the way. Other trainers tell their charges to go have sex. Mostly they hit the brothels.
Why didn't Festianos stop you?
Festianos?
When you sneaked out of the tent after I left.
Festianos wasn't there.
He wasn't?
I blinked and moved on quickly. I guess you must be anxious to get out of here, I said.
Lying in damp straw isn't the best training regimen.
Worried?
No, I'm not, oddly enough. Want to know why? Because while I'm stuck in here, no one has any expectations for me. No one's wishing me good luck. I don't have Father constantly on my back, encouraging me to train a little bit harder.
I could see his point.
You know what, Nico? Lying here with nothing to do, I've been thinking. I could get used to being a normal person.
That worried me. Temo, I have to ask this. You didn't deliberately attack Arikos in front of everyone to get out of having to compete, did you? Because in a bizarre way, I could see how being too aggressive might be an honorable way to avoid the Olympics without having to admit he didn't want to go on. Timodemus laughed.
You know me, Nico. I'm not that clever. That sounds like something only you'd think of. No one else thinks the way you do.
I'd known Timo since we were boys, and this was the first time he'd ever accused me of originality. Did he really think of me like that? I was just another young man trying to get by. I didn't think of myself as all that unusual. On the other hand, speaking of unusual acts... That reminds me, do me a favor, will you, Timo? If you meet Diotima, don't tell her about your fun with the slave girls. Diotima was almost exposed herself as a baby, and she has strong feelings about it. I'd brought a flask of watered wine and some garlic lentils and bread. I knew Timo would be hungry. We took turns dipping our hands into the wooden bowl to eat. As I licked my fingers, I said, What was Arikos like? Did you get on?
Arikos didn't have friends. He had targets. Not that I cared. I was only there to win. It's easier if you dislike the man you're hurting. Arikos was abusive.
Why did Arikos abuse you on the walk from Ellis? Timo wriggled again. He plainly wasn't comfortable.
Playing mind games, I suppose, before the contest? I was his main rival. If he could have disposed of me, he'd probably have won.
A flash of inspiration struck. With you and Arikos both out of it, who's likely to win the Pancration? Timodemus thought.
Korolos, he said. Maybe a Gellion, but my money would be on Korolos. He's good. What are you thinking, Nico?
That a man who wanted to win the Pancration would improve his chances by killing one of you and framing the other.
Nah, they're honorable men. They fight fair.
Timo paused, then said, quite abashed.
Nico, I'm sorry to spoil your games like this. You came to Olympia for fun, and here you are at work. I really am sorry, Nico.
They fight fair, Timo had said. It was the highest praise he could give a man. It was the reason I didn't want to believe he had murdered Arikos, because if Timo was the killer, it meant he'd abandoned a code of honor that he'd maintained ever since we were children. Once upon a time, a boy was lying in the street, bruised and bleeding. He was surrounded by a small gang. The boy tried to stand, but his persecutors pushed him down again. He called for help, but the men in the street walked on. After all, they were only boys playing. The boys taunted, called him coward and girl. They trod on him, and he ate the dust of the street. He didn't see what happened next. He only knew the boys had taken their feet off his back, and there was shouting. When he lifted his head, he saw another boy who hadn't been there before. The new boy shouted and punched and kicked, and the gang was scared of this little terror. He fought like a whirlwind. He was incredibly fast, never where his enemy struck, always hitting hard and bouncing out of the way. There were many, and he was one. And even lying in the dirt, the first boy could see that. If only the gang coordinated, the boys could have surrounded their tormentor, but they fought like individuals and lost like little boys. The gang yelled insults and ran down the street.
"Are you all right?"
the new boy asked, bending down to help up the one in the dirt.
"Yes,"
he sat up.
"Thank you. They were going to beat me."
"I know. Cowards. They should have fought you one at a time, not all in a gang like that."
"What would you have done if they had?"
"Let them, and watched what happened. If they fight you one at a time, then it's honorable. That's what my dad says."
"Is that why you helped me?"
He shrugged.
"It wasn't a fair fight, them beating you up all together,"
said the small boy who had taken on a dozen and won.
"Besides, I saw you try to hit them, even when you knew they were going to beat you. You didn't give up like a coward."
Timodemus became my firm friend from that day on, two lonely boys together. By rights, every boy in the city should have admired him, but they didn't. They feared him. Timodemus was mild until someone pushed him a step too far, and then he had a terrible temper, which always ended in someone else getting hurt. I think I was the only boy he never hit in anger. Because of that, we often sparred together when he needed to practice. No one else his own size would face him. And though I never had Timo's natural talent, I came to know something of the art of pancration. I know why I liked and admired Timodemus. I had never before met anyone so completely unaware of his own virtues. I don't know what he saw in me, a boy who didn't get on with other boys. I said, "Don't worry about it, Timo. Investigation is what I do. You know I'm happy to help." Timo was depressed.
"I didn't kill Arikos. But there's no way I can prove it. They're going to execute me, aren't they?"
I thought of the boy lying in the street, and I said, "No, they're not, Timo. I'm going to save you." I'd agreed to meet Marcos at the Athenian camp so we could interview One Eye and Timo's uncle Festianos together. I got there first. A slave took great delight in telling me I'd wasted my time. Festianos wasn't there, and One Eye had walked out of the camp heading south. I left a message for Marcos with the slave and threaded my way south, crouching so my head didn't show over the height of the tents to avoid my father. My head was so low I ran into a man as he walked north to the games.
"There you are," Father said. "Have you lost something?"
I
almost died when I saw you run onto the chariot track. What in Hades were you thinking? Never do such a thing again."
"Sorry, Father."
He put a hand on my shoulder.
"It was well done. All the men around me remarked on your bravery.
I was proud to tell them you were my son.
He paused and looked me over.
Are you all right?
I was shaking, not from the recollection of near death under the wheels of a chariot, but because they were the first words of praise I'd heard from my father in a long time. I swallowed and said, "Yes, father, I'm fine. Scratched and bruised, but fine." Father took me by the arm and led me to our own tents.
"That fellow who pulled you out of the path of the chariots, who is he?"
"Marcos, of Sparta."
"A Spartan, eh? Well, he saved the life of my older son. Tell him he's welcome in my home, or my tent, anytime."
"Thank you." Sophroniscus was dressed in his best formal chiton, an old but respectable ankle-length garment that covered his body, arms, and legs. It had once been brightly patterned in red, green, and yellow, but the dyes had faded, the borders were a trifle frayed, and the material stretched across his paunch. He looked about as comfortable in formal wear as a sheep wearing sandals. Father usually wore a short eximus to leave his arms and legs free to move, essential for his work, since he was a sculptor. It was strange to see him not covered in gritty marble dust. When I looked at Father, I imagined I could see the future Socrates, which wasn't hard, because Socrates at that moment sat outside our tents, turning something over in his hands and ignoring our conversation.
"I'm sorry about Timodemus, son. I know he's your friend. Are they to execute him?"
"Not if I can help it."
"Don't go getting yourself killed along with him. Your mother would never forgive me."
"I'll do my best, father." Then he frowned.
"Pythax came to see me today about this supposed marriage. He's not a happy man. Why did you have to act so rashly? Now we have this mess to sort out."
"You could approve the marriage?" I said in hope. "Pythax is happy for it to go ahead."
"Of course he is," Sophroniscus thundered. "How many former slaves can marry their medic daughters to a citizen?"
A medic was a resident alien with permission to live in Athens. The prejudice against marriage with medics was strong, and getting stronger all the time. Pericles even talked of a law to make the children of such marriages non-citizens. If that happened, Diotima and I would have a problem.
"Please, don't blame Diotima's family."
"I don't. I blame you. If you wanted to be married, son, all you had to do was ask me. Didn't I just tell you every man at Olympia remarked on your courage this morning? By the end of that race, any man in the Hippodrome would have been pleased to match his daughter with you. In fact, I had two offers as I left. It's not too late. I can still find you a good girl."
"I did find a good girl, father."
"You found a non-citizen. How do you know she won't turn to her mother's trade?"
I laughed.
"One thing I can guarantee you, father, Diotima will never be involved in prostitution."
Sophroniscus sighed, a long, deep sigh like I'd never heard from him before.
"We'll have to see what sort of a dowry this Pythax can offer to accompany his daughter."
Had I really heard that? I felt an unexpected flutter of hope.
"You mean, sir, you might consider taking Diotima after all?"
My father's shoulders tensed, and he shuffled his feet like a guilty man.
"I hate to admit it, son, but business has been slow. Too slow. The truth is, we're close to the point where I'll not be able to feed the family."
"Oh, I didn't realize."
"I know you didn't. You've been too busy gallivanting about. But if your Diotima comes to us with enough dowry to keep our heads above water, well, I'd have to consider that very carefully.
Is there anything I can do, Father?
I asked. I was genuinely, deeply, and suddenly concerned. He lived for sculpting. If he were unable to continue, it would break him.
I need work, son. Perhaps one of these athletes will commission me for his victory statue.
Dawn lit up for me.
So that's why you flocked to congratulate the winners. I thought you'd become a sports fan.
If it will help win work, I'll join the mob.
He sighed.
There are too many good sculptors. Onatus of Aegina is here. So is Myron of Eleuthere.
Sophroniscus named the most fashionable, most popular, and most expensive sculptors in Hellas.
If I see a chance to help...
Oh, so you have time to work with your father now?
No, I mean yes, but Father, if I find someone who needs a statue...
You'll mention it, yes. I know you will, son. By the way, there was a message left for you.
A messenger? What did he say?
No messenger. A written message. And we don't know how it got here. It's all a bit of a mystery. Socrates has it.
Socrates sat outside our tents. He'd ignored our conversation. Instead, he stared at something in his hands. He'd obviously fallen into one of his trances, during which he was oblivious to the world. Father and I had both become accustomed to his strange behavior.
Socrates!
Sophroniscus yelled into my brother's ear.
Wake up, will you?
Socrates looked up as if he'd suddenly noticed the world existed.
What? Show Nico the message,
our father said. Socrates held out the thing in his hand. It was an ostracon, a piece of broken pottery, red on the outside and black on the inside. On this one, words had been scratched in stark white into the inner black. He said the secrets would kill me too if I told you, but I had to do something. The Athenian didn't do it. The secrets killed the Spartan.
Where did you find this?
I demanded.
In the middle of our tent, Socrates said. When I returned from the chariot race, it lay in the middle, where you couldn't miss it.
The tent flap had been up. Anyone could have tossed it in as he walked by.
What secrets could kill a man?
I asked myself aloud.
Many, Sophroniscus said. You're old enough to know that.
I inspected the ostracon closely to deduce what I could from it. I hoped for a clue as to who might have thrown it into our tent. Then I sighed.
It's difficult, isn't it, Nico?
Socrates sympathized.
It certainly is.
Yes. Other than that the writer was a nervous, left-handed man with a blunt knife and tawny-colored hair, there's almost nothing we can get from it. But you know that, of course.
I almost dropped the ostracon.
You can't possibly know all those things,
I said, but I was afraid he could.
Sure you can, Nico,
he said. He was too absorbed in the problem to notice the insult.
See here where the knife has slipped? It slipped from left to right, so he held the ostracon in his right hand and the knife in his left.
Now that he pointed it out, it was obvious.
All right,
I granted.
But the blunt knife?
The same slip happens here and here and here.
Socrates pointed to the slight scratches.
The knife point wouldn't hold.
I had to concede he was right.
And the nervousness?
He can spell secrets, but not didn't. He couldn't think straight.
I knew what to look for now. I rotated the shard until I found the short hair trapped in a crack at the bottom edge, where the break was particularly ragged. I didn't know how a hair could have caught there, but there was no doubt it was tawny-colored. I put the ostracon in a cloth pouch and tied it to my belt. I had no idea what it meant, but I'd find out. This was the first evidence that Timo might be innocent. Good work, Socrates.
Thanks, Nico.
Socrates beamed. I found One Eye in a dusty patch he'd taken for an exercise ring, surrounded by dry, spindly grass. Not an official athlete, One Eye wasn't permitted use of the Olympic facilities. He danced about in the dust in a sequence of oddly elegant movements, each ending in a blow, a kick, or a punch against the empty air. One Eye practiced the standard routine of a pancratist. He danced naked and glistened with sweat. The red, empty eye socket gave him the forbidding look of an angry cyclops. He snarled and grunted, dodged, swerved, and struck so smoothly that I knew I observed a daily routine. One Eye might have been an old man, but I, for one, wouldn't have wanted to face him. I doubted anyone but a current contestant could have taken him on. One Eye saw me, but he didn't stop his practice. If anything, his momentum increased ever so slightly. Had he picked up the pace to impress me? I said nothing but waited for the routine to slow to a halt, which it finally did.
Nikolaos,
he acknowledged me. He began to alternate jogging in place and straining his arms against a large piece of granite.
Very impressive, sir. Are you finished? The heavy, useful part of the routine is over, yes. I must cool down slowly now, or the muscles will not.
Does Festianos exercise like this too, sir? Where is he? One Eye laughed, but without humor.
My brother has let himself go these last years. But perhaps I shouldn't criticize too much, he allowed. My brother has been afflicted with poor health. No, Festianos has gone to the stadium to watch the pentathlon.
Oh, of course. I'd forgotten for a moment there were games on. I don't suppose you know where I could find him on the hill.
He left late. I imagine he'll be toward the back, close to the entrance.
One Eye continued his warm-down exercise without pause while we talked.
Don't you want to watch too, sir? I asked. There's only one sport I care about, young man, and it's not the pentathlon.
I see.
You're the one assigned to free my son. Why aren't you out doing it?
It's why I'm here, sir. There are some questions I have to ask.
I know nothing about the killing, One Eye said at once. Except that it was thoroughly deserved.
Arakos didn't deserve to die, a voice said.
Marcos came to a halt beside me. He was surprisingly calm, considering One Eye had just consigned a Spartan to Hades. One Eye looked him over.
You're the Spartan they assigned to make sure my son dies, Marcos said mildly. I'm the Spartan assigned to investigate a murder. Then perhaps your time would be better expended elsewhere. Chasing the killer, for example.
The tension oozed between One Eye and Marcos, between One Eye and me. I said, One Eye, I understand your love for your son makes you anxious.
My love? When I learned my wife was pregnant,
I sacrificed to Zeus for a son. I sacrificed every day of her term. Do you understand why?
Because you wanted a son? One-Eye snorted.
If that's your idea of incisive deduction, then my son is doomed. Yes, you idiot, I wanted a son, so that I could pass on to him the family tradition of the Pancratian.
Why did you say just now that the death was deserved?
Marcos asked, then added, his voice dripping with irony.
Please, don't mind my feelings in your answer.
One-Eye turned to me.
I know you've talked to my son. He must have told you what transpired on the march here.
I knew, because Pindar had told me. Teemo hadn't thought to mention it. It occurred to me that my friend Teemo hadn't told me everything. I said,
I heard. Arikos harassed Teemo.
Arikos had it coming. Like most Spartans, he was an arrogant bastard.
One-Eye glared at Marcos, daring him to interject. Marcos kept his face a carefully controlled mask. He was a superb interrogator. One-Eye went on.
Whoever got him, I'll wager it was someone understandably angered beyond control.
I wondered if he realized that description might apply to him or to his son. For the first time, I noticed how Timo's propensity to wild anger had been inherited from his father. I asked,
Did Dromaeus really prescribe sex as part of the training regimen?
One-Eye frowned.
Dromaeus says it keeps the athlete's muscles relaxed, and I have to admit the results seem to prove him right. It's one of those newfangled theories, like the meat-only diet everyone swears by these days.
One-Eye shook his head.
It's unbelievably expensive. Do you know what red meat costs?
So you disagreed with Dromaeus on Timo's training regimen?
Oh, no, I'm not getting into that argument. Haven't you wondered why I, an expert in the Pancration, hired an expensive personal trainer for my son?
I did wonder.
In fact, it had never occurred to me, but I didn't want to appear stupid.
It's because a father is not always the most objective when it comes to his own son. A more dispassionate eye can see and correct faults an indulgent father might pass over.
One-Eye thought he was indulgent?
You were my son's friend.
I still am.
And for that, I forgive you these impertinent questions. But there will be no more from either of you. Free my son, Nikolaos. Preferably by tomorrow. Being cooped up in that room is terrible preparation for the contest.
Marcos said,
Sir, the judges of the game set Timo's trial for the last day of the games.
Marcos didn't add the obvious, that they'd done so in order to execute him at once if the judgment went against him.
Then bring forward the trial.
What?
I couldn't believe him.
You heard me. The Pancration is the last event on the fourth day. Timodemus must be free by then, or he won't be able to compete.
I said, Sir, it's for the judges to decide.
But if you told the judges you could prove his innocence, they would hear you early, would they not?
I suppose so, I said, with the greatest reluctance.
But One Eye.
Good. Tell them, then.
Wouldn't it help if we solved the crime first?
Young man, you don't need to find this killer. You merely need to prove it could not be my son. Surely you can do that.
Marcos and I looked at each other in disbelief. For the first time, Marcos was at a loss for words. Right now, One Eye, I can do no such thing. In fact, on the face of it, Timodemus did kill the Spartan.
You don't believe that.
He tossed weights into the air and caught them. No, sir. But it's what any impartial judge will decide. Let me do my job in the time allotted, sir, and if Zeus grants me the victory, then your son will return home with you, alive and free.
I hoped for more than that.
More? I don't understand, One Eye.
Timo won at Nemea last year, no matter what they say. You should ignore the ugly rumors.
I blinked. What rumors?
I just told you to ignore them. If Timo wins here at the Sacred Games, then it remains only for him to win at Corinth and Delphi, both easier competitions, and he will have won every major title on the competition circuit. Those who achieve such a feat are entitled to name themselves Paradoxus.
Paradoxus, the marvel, Timodemus the marvel, because to achieve 4 straight victories is almost impossible. Dear gods, his son was held in a prison awaiting execution, and One Eye could only think of how they would win the next contest.
The advantages that accrue to a Paradoxus are great indeed,
One Eye went on. Had the man no grip on reality? He'd be lucky if Timo still breathed come the next contest, let alone won it. Marcos said,
Then it would help, sir, if you could give us any clue as to who might have killed Arachos. You've been around the Pancration all your life. You know everyone in the sport. What do you think?
It wouldn't surprise me in the least if Dromaeus killed the Spartan.
I blinked. Had One Eye just shopped his own head coach for the crime? He'd said it as easily as if he discussed the weather. Are you serious? I had to ask.
Certainly I am.
Why would Dromaeus want to kill Arachos?
Marcos asked.
Dromaeus saw some hard times after his Olympic crown. He was widely considered the weakest Olympic victor ever. He turned to coaching to bolster his reputation, and he achieved some success, which is why I hired him. But Timodemus is the first of his charges to have a real chance at the crown. Dromaeus is desperate for this win.
And you aren't, I thought to myself, but didn't dare say it. Instead, I said, Merely wanting to win a sporting contest hardly seems a motive for a serious attack.
Doesn't it? Look at me, Nikolaos.
He grabbed me by the shoulders and pulled me so close that my entire vision was filled with his face. His hot, angry breath blew on my face.
Here now!
Marcus moved to save me, but I waved him back.
What do you see?
One Eye rasped. I could see the broken nose from his many fights, the pockmarked skin, dark and splotchy from years of practice under the sun, and, above all else, the ugly red hole where his right eye had been. It was scarred and puckered. A layer of grime lay within the empty socket,
where the sandy dust of the practice ring had settled.
A man who has spent his life in the Pancration, I whispered. I wondered if Timo would one day look like this.
Do you know how I lost this eye?
Timo told me once, long ago.
Did he tell you the details?
I shook my head.
It was at the Nemean Games, when I was the age my son is today. I was a pancratist, one of the very best. Not the best. There was no clear best, but I was among the top four or five, let us say. Any one of us had a hope of Olympic glory. I'd reached the semi-finals of Nemea. I was confident, very confident. I'd won easily in every round. I knew I was fighting better than every man present, and these were the men who'd be going on to the sacred games the next year. I allowed myself to hope that if I kept up my training and worked hard, then perhaps the crown of the sacred games was within my grasp.
One Eye's one remaining good eye glistened. If it had been anyone else, I might have suspected a tear was forming.
My opponent in the semi-finals was weak. He wouldn't have made it so far, except the gods had seen fit to grant him a bye in the earlier round. I faced him, and by his stance, I knew I could take him. I could see in his eyes that he knew it too. The umpires called time, and we entered the ring. We faced each other, and I let him approach. Then sand flew into my eyes. He'd thrown it. He'd kept his hands clenched to hide the grit he held. I was blinded and fell back. He jumped on top of me. The next thing I felt were the fingers hooked behind my ears and the thumbs in my eyeballs. I could hear the umpires screaming and the whips striking his back, but he didn't stop. I tried to turn my head to save my sight, but I felt my right eyeball slide out.
That was definitely a tear on his cheek. I thought that One Eye was about to weep, but he held it back.
I still have nightmares. For one hideous moment I saw my own face. Then it was gone, and I was left screaming on the ground. They carried me away, my trainer and my father, to the doctor to save what they could. He applied the branding iron to cauterize the wound.
One Eye shuddered.
It was a Spartan who gouged out my eye. He claimed it was an accident, which made him a liar as well as a cheat. All he got was a beating, while I could have been an Olympic victor.
One Eye let go of me, and I staggered back.
So guess what? I don't give a shit about any dead Spartan. But hear me on this, friend of my son.
In his rage, the spittle flew from his mouth. I felt it spatter on my face.
Timodemus gets his chance to go where I failed. And that means you've got to get him out in time for the Pancration.
What if I can't?
Then it doesn't matter whether he lives or dies, because his whole life will have been wasted.
Nice friends you have, Marco said as we walked away.
I was shaking. All these years I'd known Timodemus, been at his house, played there as a boy, yet never had I talked to One Eye long enough to realize what a driven,
brutal man he could be. The father of Timodemus isn't my friend. I recalled the horrible sight of Arikos as he lay face up in the dirt. There'd been ugly red holes where his eyes had been torn out, holes that matched the terrible scar in One Eye's own face. And One Eye had admitted a Spartan disfigured him. I hoped Marcos didn't make the same connection. Marcos and I had to push our way through the entrance to the stadium. The way was narrow, the crowd immense. It squeezed the shambling men to two abreast, down a roofed passage not more than 15 paces long. A voice beside us said,
"The Hellenes pass through the birth canal of the entrance into the clean, open world of the Stadion."
We both turned, startled, to see Pindar at my elbow. Even in this crowd, he carried the manner of a priest. Men about us gave him room, and he slid in to join us, with Marcos to his left and me to his right.
"I notice the two of you push your way into the queue," he said. "I was intrigued, of course, so I slipped in behind. Are you young gentlemen hot on the heels of the malefactor?"
"If Zeus favors us," I said, and then, hearing my own words, said, "Cursed Pindar, I'm beginning to sound like you."
"That would be a distinct improvement. Did I hear you say birth canal?" Marcos said. "Consider the layout, my friends," Pindar said, as the crowd of which we were a part shuffled into the tunnel. "The goddess Hera, she who is wife to Zeus and matron to the gods, her temple opens directly onto this path down which we tread. Men are squeezed into the short tunnel before us, whence we emerge into the open stadion. So Hera gives birth to us all." I was aghast.
"You're not serious, are you, Pindar?" Marcus said.
"It's a metaphor, lads. Poets are very keen on metaphors. They sell like honey cakes. I thought of the birth canal idea many Olympiads ago, when I was a young man. I've always wanted to get it into a victory song, but I never found the opportunity."
"I can't imagine why," Marcos said. "Unless they introduce Olympic childbirthing as an event."
"No sillier than Olympic detecting," Pindar pointed out. "And I must beg to disagree with you on the chance of Olympic childbirth. What would our illustrious ancestors say if they knew these days we have an Olympic mule race? Never underestimate the power of human stupidity, my boy. After the acts of the gods, the mistakes of mortals are the single greatest decider of our fates."
"Did you really write a victory song for the mule race?"
"I did, but I used one of my generics."
"Generics?"
"I prepare them in advance and then fill in the victor's name later."
We found Festianos where One Eye had guessed he'd be, standing at the back of the crowd on the low hill that ran the length of the stadium, which was a good thing, because we could never have pushed through the densely packed men to find him anywhere else. The hill had been covered in grass when I first saw it 2 days ago. Now I felt nothing but bare dirt between my toes. 10,000 men walking across it for 2 days had had the expected effect. "Festianos," I said. He looked up at me in surprise, then to my right where Marcos stood. His eyes narrowed. Festianos had the family height, which is to say, not much. But, unlike One Eye and Timo, Festianos had let himself run to fat. He was pudgy and entirely bald. His eyes had dark rings around them. I guess that was due to excessive partying.
"We need to talk to you," I said to him. Suddenly,